thought that we were going to be meeting at 90 Place Street. They went there. I don't know if there are still other people outside there. Can we, in welcoming everybody in here, introduce ourselves so that we can start the business of the day? My name is Fred Gona. I'm the chairperson of this portfolio committee. On my left is
Jali, member of this committee.
Here we go, just member of the committee.
My name is Mabel. I'm from PMG.
I'm Vakera Tamwana, preliminary officer.
I'm Puchi Zegalala from the State Diamond Trader.
My name is Linda Makatini, also from the State Diamond Trader.
Johnson Tetra from South African Diamond and Precious Metal Regulator.
Billy Manoku from the Regulator.
Thomas Kosala from the South African Diamond and Precious Metal Regulator.
Nompula Mativela, member of the committee.
Board of Chairperson member, Mosama Buza from the Department of Mineral Resources.
I'm Charlotte Lucian from the Department of Mineral Resources.
Tony Ramon, Secretary to the committee.
Can we ask people who sit around there to also come closer to the mics? Can I ask you, sir?
My name is Marty Lothar. I'm a guest. I'm also with the South African Diamond Producers Organization.
I'm Enrico Barizzi. I'm a committee assistant at Parliament.
Good morning, and Nick Garvey from Sabinet.
Welcome, Honorable Dele.
Don't wait that long.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, we have quite a tight schedule today in that primarily, we are going to be listening to the two presentations, one from the State Diamond Trader, the other one later on will be from the regulator. And therefore, it does mean that we will have to be very mindful of the time management. We will ask the State Diamond Trader to then take us through. We engage with that presentation. Once we dispense with it, then we hand over to the precious metals regulator to also give us their take on their annual report. With this hope that members have had these reports in their possession for quite some time now, we hope that within your busy schedules, you were able to at least glance over the reports, and you've got some of your questions prepared. May I therefore take this opportunity to hand over to the State Diamond Trader Delegation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. As I said before, Linda Makatini, I'm the chairperson of the State Diamond Trader with my acting Chief Executive Officer, Ms. Gilalana. We will hopefully be able, between the two of us, to answer all the questions that members may have with regards to the report. My presentation will be very brief, and I will hopefully be expecting more information to come up from the type of questions that you would like to know. Um, our presentation will be looking briefly at those issues that we've outlined there, our vision, mission, our objectives, how we've managed to set up our governance framework, the challenges that we've had since our establishment.
Hold on, there seems to be questions. Yes, my Honorable Tinda?
No, sir, it's not a question. I'm
calling you. Oh, okay. Please continue, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. So we'll go through all those issues there in our financial performance, all of which is also contained in our full report. Just to remind members very briefly that we were established in terms of Section 14 of the Diamonds Amendment Act in 2005. I see most of very familiar members here who will recall the struggle that was here before it was set up and all the discussions that took place with the industry and generally the South African community. We have then had, since our establishment, challenges. I think I will refer to this later on, with the manner that the industry interprets the outcome of the parliamentary process in terms of the Act. But that is how we were established. Section 59B, read with the regulations, stipulates that stipulates the procedures that we need to follow to access diamonds from producers, and the minister has got authority to acquire up to 10% of every production from every producer in South Africa. We determined our vision, informed by the Act, to be that we needed to ensure that we deepen and broaden the local diamond beneficiation. Our mission as the SDC is to ensure equitable, consistent, and sustainable access rough diamonds to the local diamond beneficiaries. That's how we interpreted the mandate that was given by Parliament. We had strategic objectives that were set for 2007 to 2009. We felt that it was very important that we needed to improve our relations with the IBC. As you recall, members, we are funded by the IGC, we get a loan from the IGC, and that is how we are able to pay for the diamonds that we acquire from the producers. Our strategic thrust was also to ensure that we are able to purchase and sell rough diamonds to the beneficiaries, and we needed to focus also on addressing the previously disadvantaged individuals who could not have access to all the diamonds and make sure that we build the local beneficiation industry. We also, as our strategic objective, wanted to ensure that we complied with all the legislation required, including obviously the PSMA and other treasury regulations. We also wanted to ensure that we get all the transfer of skills possible from the DBS technical staff. Just to remind members, there was a technical agreement between the State Diamond Trader and DBS where they volunteered to give us staff and equipment for a period that will allow us to set up as a State Diamond Trader. So it was very important that at the end of that term, we were able to have a self-sustainable State Diamond Trader. So those were our strategic objectives. After being in operation...
Sorry, Chairperson. Let's disturb you a bit. There's quite a serious sound noise coming out of our speakers. And the technician there is trying to locate the problem and trying to sort it out, because your voice is getting drowned through this noise that comes out of here. Chairperson, the technician says that the noise we're hearing are from the projector in front of you. Can you move to a mic a bit away from there, if that's possible for you? Please make space for her somewhere. Oh, that's much better.
Hello? Much better. Okay, great. So, after being in operation for a year or so, we were able as a state diamond trader to identify certain areas that we needed to focus on more that were impacting on our operations. For example, we realized that the funding model that had been approved and that we're operating under had some serious constraints because it required us to have a markup on all the diamonds that we bought by the time we sold them to the industry, to the cutters and polishers. We had to have put up quite a serious markup, well, not a serious markup, but we had to put up to 4%. And we realized that this actually constrains us in meeting our full mandate. So when we reviewed our strategic objectives, we decided as a board that it would be important to get some guaranteed state funding for the operations of the SDT, so that our focus is more on making diamonds available than making diamonds, than availing diamonds at a price that had a markup which made it difficult for some of the players to buy into our operations. We then also realized in our reviewed strategic objectives that we needed to seek some regulatory amendments on our mandate to make sure that we're able to trade profitable. For example, parts of the goods that we buy are small goods that we are unable to cut and polish in South Africa. Some of our players, they come into the state diamond trader, they buy these small diamonds, and then they immediately go next door to our offices and they export them because there's a limit to how much they can export. So we felt that also as a board, it may not be a bad idea to seek regulatory amendments that would allow us as a state diamond trader, where we have been unable to attract a customer for these goods, to be able to export those goods ourselves or to benefit from that export so that we can make sure that there are more diamonds available. That's our proposal. We also wanted to focus on improving the profitability of the SDT's operation to ensure that we're sustainable. We wanted to continue to contribute to a sustainable development of the local diamond beneficiation industry. We also felt that it would be important as the Act allows us to engage with other African diamond producing countries, that it is important for us to maintain relations so that we are able to exchange ideas with them and in the long term to be able to trade with them to ensure that there is more access of diamonds for our South African cutters and polishers. Our last strategic review was that we felt that it was important to accelerate in our admin systems, procedures and controls to make sure that we're better able to comply with the Treasury regulation. Our governance framework, I think I've said this before, that we're focused on complying with the PFMA, and I'm happy to inform the committee that we're able to do that. We have a culture of promoting a culture of ethical behavior within the organization, overseeing risk management, and ensuring sound corporate governance in the manner that we operate. We were able to do that. However, there were challenges that we faced during the year under review, and I've summarized them in the following: legislative challenges, funding challenges, and the global financial downturn that we experienced during this period. On the legislative challenges, I think I've alluded a bit to the fact that we realized that we are not able to exploit as far as possible all the diamonds that we access. At some point in time, we're not able to deal with that chain in a manner that we would like to. With regards to the funding, sorry, still on the legislative, we also have a challenge that I alluded to in the beginning, where some players in the industry, almost in challenging our operation as the SDT, open up the whole debate that we had at the time of inception of the SDT. So we have the same arguments that this committee, the previous committee, had dealt with. In some instances, people deliberately choose to misinterpret the law, and in some instances, I think it's a honest, genuine misunderstanding. As far as possible, our doors remain open to explain to the players what the actual legislative position is. On the funding issue, I've also alluded to that, that we have realized that if the state diamond trader is to focus on making diamonds available to make sure that we are able to do so as cheaply as possible. And if we were to access some sort of state funding for our day-to-day existence in terms of paying rent and paying staff and admin costs, then we feel that we'd be able to meet this mandate better. The global financial downturn hit us very badly indeed. We lost quite a lot of momentum that we were at the beginning of our start. The diamond industry, as most of you will be aware, was very hard hit by this because everybody believed that a diamond is a luxury, so it was the first luxury that was affected by the global downturn. We will see the figures later, what this cost us. The other challenge that I think that I would like to allude to that may not be in the slide is that we also had a challenge throughout this time to continuously build internal capacity, because when the De Beers service level agreement ends in October this year, we also had a challenge of making sure that we have a structure that is independent. But however, because of lack of funding, we were operating using staff that had been seconded from the Department of Mining Resources. So we still were unable to have enough money to access our own staff. From the CEO to the company secretary, we have seconded staff members. Now, looking at the global financial downturn, so are we on client performance? I'm jumping. Are you jumping, C, or am I jumping? Is it the global financial downturn?
Where are you?
I'm on the global financial downturn. Between July 2008 and mid-2009, this was a serious problem in the diamonds. I think all resources, but I believe that the diamond industry was hard hit. But not only was it because people regarded it as a luxury good, production by diamond producers also reduced significantly in South Africa. There was not so much production taking place. The polished markets were not performing as well. And though we are beginning to see some signs of recovery, I still think that we are a long way away from where we were in 2007 and before. There are some pockets of positive moves, and then you go down again. On client performance, we have to date 105 registered customers that are customers of the State Diamond Trader, and of these 105, 68 made purchases during the year under review. We separated the clients based on size. There were 4 large clients, 12 medium clients, and 52 of these clients are small. Now, I have to say, when we were identifying clients, we asked all people in the diamond industry to put in their applications and also to tell us the type of goods that they wanted to work with. I'm happy to say that we did not turn down anyone at all who wished to be a client of the State Diamond Trader, but what we did is we created a system that allows for everyone periodically to be called up to come and view the goods that we have and to buy. Unfortunately, we have not had too many small clients coming in to purchase during the year under review, and we've been concerned about this lack of participation from a group that we believe is our target group. We have placed a lot of effort in continuously engaging with them. We have client meetings every quarter where we meet and try and understand what their challenges are in ensuring that they're able to buy. Maybe during discussions it will come up, but just briefly, some of the challenges that they listed to us is lack of finances, and it is also the fact that they are unable to produce some of the basic business certificates that they need to have to operate. Their tax certificates lapse, and therefore we no longer can keep them in our books when that happens, but we try and assist as much as we can.
medium and large clients have continued to trade with the SDT, but not as much as we would have liked to see. If you look at our financial performance overall, I think that if you see that growth there, 144% increase, it was really because that the year previously we had not operated in a full year, so it wasn't. And the 144% just indicates that the following year we were trading for a full year as opposed to a few months. We had a gross margin decline in percentage, and this was also indicating the 11% decline was indicating the start of the economic downturn in the industry. Our capital expenditure for the year increased also, I think the main reason being the fact that we're operating for a full year as opposed to a partial year. We also had admin expenses increasing. But the bullet point that I'd like us to look at there is this impairment of instant inventory that I spoke to about earlier, the downturn. We had bought some goods just before the downturn started. We had some stock in our hands. And the loss of that stock by the time we finally sold it was plus 5 million rand. That just indicates the amount of gravity that the downturn hit us with. We ended up selling that stock at a serious loss, but also we realized that keeping it, it was getting cheaper by the day. Almost it was as ridiculous as by the hour. In some instances, the price that you got an hour before just kept on going down. Trading performance. Sorry, financial performance. I don't have the slides to you. I look at this. Financial performance, we have, as you see there, an unfavorable bank balance. As of March, we were at 61,785. We had income tax for the year that was outstanding. Board fees had been unpaid at the end of the year, and I have to say that board members continued to be very committed to attend events, and we're meeting more regularly than most boards, obviously, because it was at the time when we were facing a lot of challenges and operating without full-time staff component. I've mentioned that we operate using seconded staff from the Department of Mining Resources and DBS, and during the time that we were ending that year, we had serious concerns about that we're in a position of technical insolvency, and the AG raised concerns about our ability to continue to trade, because clearly we found ourselves in a situation where we're not trading, and because we're not trading, we're not making any money, and we're not unable to operate. So that's the situation we found ourselves in. The trading performance for the period April to September 2009, we began to, as a board, look at solutions that could assist us to come out of this trading, this challenge that we had, technical insolvency, and we took a decision that we needed to continue to trade regardless of the challenges, because the focus was to promote local beneficiation. So we introduced a system of trading on a pre-finance basis only for a six-month period. We are concerned that some of the small clients are not able to come in and buy in this system, but for 6 months we were able then at least to bring our books to a situation where we could continue to trade. The way the pre-finance basis works is that we identify goods from a producer. We indicate to the potential clients who are called on invitation whether or not they are clients of the SDT. We tell them the type of goods that are available, so they buy the goods on a closed parcel. So it's based on trust. We tell them what is in the parcel, and then we're able to take the money from them and actually pay the producer directly, which allows us to be able to avoid having stock at hand, which led us to have that 5 million loss, because we don't know. So we talk to you, we buy, and it's just a simple exchange. The trading performance for the period to the end of the second quarter, I think you will see that it
put us in a situation where we had a gross profit of $5 million. So this is where we are now. Now, the future outlook for the State Diamond Trader. Since we operated, we have not had any qualified audit. We've had a few challenges, but we've never gotten to the stage where we received a qualified audit. We are seeing improved trading, and indications are that we are going to have a very positive growth. The pre-trading policy, the board has approved that it only continues until the end of the financial year, because we believe that at that time we'll be able to have a better financial outlook and the industry, the recession, would be looking a little bit better. We see ourselves reviewing our strategy, including the legislative changes that I have mentioned, which we will be proposing to the shareholder, and the funding model. And we are obviously at all times having ongoing implementation of cost-cutting measures. We will also be looking at putting in place as soon as possible State Diamond Trader employees as opposed to using seconded staff. October is very close when the beers would be in a position where they would have to move out and leave us to fend on our own. We continue to engage the shareholder on sourcing appropriate funding, and we are hoping that we will participate effectively in the development of the beneficiation strategy and policy that is taking place at the moment within government, and we'll be able to improve the operational capacity of the State Diamond Trader. With that, I thank you, and also thank you for this opportunity to come and present our challenges, report, and flash the good news to the committee. Thank you
very much. Would that be all from the side? Any additions?
I'm not sure whether the CEO would like to add anything.
No, not now, Chairperson. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much for the precise presentation on your report. Honorable members, it's open for your take in terms of questions, inputs. I note Honorable Tindo, I note Honorable Lucas, Honorable Schmidt. I'll take those for now. Over to you, Honorable Tindo.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, Ms. Makatini, for your honest report. I think as a person who's been in this committee for some time, I've never listened to a very good report from the State Diamond Trade. But I think there's a little bit of improvement, although there are losses. I'm sure the losses can be expected, because diamond is for people that have got money, and people like me who don't have money, who don't worry about diamonds. But I don't hear any plans that you have to recover the losses that you had. Maybe if you can look at the recovery, I'm sure something can be done. I don't agree with the AG that says the you have to close shop. I don't think you must close shop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also must say that thank you for the report. I think the whole idea was to encourage beneficiation. And unfortunately, we've had this global downturn in the industry. And I think this is basically what has caused most of the problems. And I would also like to say that we need to find a way. How can we remedy the situation? We need to really find a way, sit down and say, how can we do this? Because this is one of the things that we keep on pushing on, beneficiation. And there is this added problem, the seconded staff. when that comes to an end, we must be sure that we're going to, that's an added expense. And I think even big companies like De Beers are also feeling the pinch at the moment, because this is not going a good way. But the question I'd just like to ask, how is the, I don't know where I'm out of line, the Khabarovni project going? Didn't we lose, was that a good idea that we built that establishment outside the country? Or, it's just on hindsight, what do we think now?
Honorable Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a bit more concerned about the inherent viability of that organization. You know, my concern is that I've seen documents where indicating that before, for instance, the State Diamond Trader came into existence, there were people called the small alluvial miners, and I'm not sure how you interact with them, but you know, there were 1,000 of them before the Amendment Act came into operation, there now 200, where 240,000 people roughly were dependent on that mining industry, and now less than 40,000 people dependent. So what I'm basically saying, the State Diamond Trader has not facilitated job creation. In fact, it has created exactly the opposite. And then you add to it, and okay, there might be a reason, certain argument saying the economic crisis, but you have of that, I can understand that you've got a 1.5 million loss due to, I think it's, you call it, the sale of diamonds for a lesser amount than what you had purchased it for, and that's 1.5. But your overall loss is 5 million. So there's an inherent viability, especially when you consider that, as I understand it, the legislation provides for 10% of a run of mine by a particular producer has to be tendered to the State Diamond Trader. That seems not to have happened. It seems to me that it has to be done on a fair value by a evaluator. Now, the whole existence, purpose and existence of the State Diamond Trader seems to have been short-circuited by yourself when you are now acting as what you call a passive purchaser, because you are now merely the facilitator between the purchaser and the producer without purchasing. You are now saying, I'll facilitate you purchasing from the producer. You're nothing more than a facilitator at this point in time. That's a reason for concern, because the whole structure of the system for which it was intended to act for has now fallen flat on its face. Not only due to, well, I suppose partially due to economic circumstances, but the role model seems to be inherently flawed. If you buy at fair value, and then you sell that at fair value to a purchaser, how do you make a profit? You know, somewhere there's a shortage in the link. And I know the IDC provides funding, but it can't provide funding to an institution and act as a welfare organization to a facilitator where it could purchase that same diamond from the producer directly on the open market, or whichever tender house system which prevailed and the current system. So my concern is, and I think the other question I'll put to the regulator, but I think so far as yourself is concerned, that is my concern. What is it that makes you inherently a profitable organization? Thank you.
We note Honorable Ngele and Honorable Matibela, but can we allow them to respond to this first round? And you will take your comment on the second bite. Please, the State Demonstrator.
Thank you very much. The first question, I think, from Honorable Tinto, was how we were going to try and recover the losses that we had made so far, and that the AG has requested us to close shop. First, I'd like to address that one. We have not been requested to close shop yet. And I think that would be, if that was to come up, that would be a regression, I think, of the vision that this committee previously had and its insight in creating an institution that was going to ensure that South African produced diamonds stay and are beneficiated by South Africans. So that has not happened as yet, Honourable Member. With regards to the issue of the plans to recover losses, I think that in a business entity, when you make a loss such as that, you buy more expensive than you finally have to sell for reasons that are outside your control. It's difficult to recover, particularly on that parcel. But how we are trying to recover from that is this initiative that I have been indicating that as a board, we are trying to find ways of allowing us to continue to exist whilst we are looking at the funding model to see that this funding model that we have tried now for 2 years, is it actually the best model that we could have? And that will continuously, and I think, as I said, we're about to make changes, that will continuously be looked at until we find the right model. So we are continuing to trade, and I don't think we'll recover on those particular diamonds, but we'll continue to learn from that and learn lessons that we need to take. Honorable Lucas, I think is correct to raise the issue that the idea was to encourage beneficiation, and that idea still remains, I think, our focus and our mandate. How to remedy the situation, this is exactly why, honorable members, we are taking our experience on the ground, because previously when this act was mooted and discussed and passed by this House, it was an idea. Now, we are coming as a state diamond trader saying that we have been on the ground, we have seen challenges here and there, and we'll continue to come to yourself and come up with new ideas of perhaps this can best happen this way. I don't believe that anybody believed that the first 2 years of the state diamond trader will produce a perfect model that didn't need to be changed here and there to adjust to the situation. The question that honorable member raises about whether Khadoroni was a good idea or not, you will recall that even during the presentation, that was a decision De Beers had taken outside anybody's, you know, it was their right. And they were adamant that it was a good idea for De Beers. So it's difficult for me to comment as a South African and as somebody who's chairing a South African entity. If you ask me, yes, I would have liked all those diamonds to come to South Africa. That would be the best option for South Africa, but they chose Khadoroni for whatever commercial reasons. But I am aware that as all the diamonds all over the world are affected, that there has been some delays, and I'm not sure whether the projected figures are as they are now. So they've also been affected, but that was a decision that the BS took. Honorable Smith raises the issue relating to the viability of the state diamond trader, and I'd like to discuss first whether the existence of the state diamond trader has then affected the alluvial producers. The state diamond trader, if members recall, its responsibility is, well, legal powers, is to access up to 10% of all production from all the producers in South Africa. The first 2 years, we have not even as a state diamond trader been able to complete agreements in accessing the 10% from all the producers, big producers in South Africa, let alone the alluvial miners. So I find it hard to understand then the debate that there is something that we have done that has then affected their existence, and the fact that there's now less than our 40% less than they were before we came, because they are still continuing to operate outside our interference, because they produce. The long-term target is that we should be able as a state diamond trader to get even to the guy who produces 2 stones and say, let us have your 10% run of mine from that, because the law requires that we need to access that. So we have not been able to do that. But I am aware of debates outside that our very existence has affected the alluvial diggers. We have not been able to do that. Alluvial diggers continue to operate, and what we do with the 10% is that we make it available to cutters and polishers. So for me, I've got a breaking linkage of how our existence has affected that. And we have not facilitated job creation. That, again, I think that is one of the myths that I have had since I've chaired the industry. And again, I have a problem with having a link. First, there was a company that De Beers was running. This company was called DMDA. In my previous years, when I was acting CEO of the what we now call the regulator, this is now going back as far back as 1996. The biggest problem that we had was from casters and polishers complaining that DMDL is unable to provide diamonds to all the people, the casters and polishers, because they export everything and there is nothing for South Africans. Because when you bought a DMDL, it did not matter whether you wanted to produce, to polish the diamond in South Africa or everywhere else. It was just a conduit of you buy the diamond and you do whatever. Now, here comes in the state diamond trader saying that we will only sell to you if we know that you've got a factory. We'll only sell to you if you can prove to us that you are going to beneficiate here in South Africa. We'll only sell to you if we can guarantee for ourselves that you are cutting and polishing for the benefit of South Africans. Again, then I lose the argument that our very existence, we're now stopping people from coming from one corridor to the next, exporting and taking it out, and we are now saying that you have to prove to us. We need to see your factory. We need to see how many people you've employed. Then we will sell to you, become a client. How then we have also then resulted in job losses. We may have resulted in job losses in India and Israel. I have to take that. Maybe we are responsible for that, but not in South Africa. Yet there is a reality that since we've come on board, there have been factories closing. And I think that it would be not realistic not to link that to aggressive economic downturn. People are cutting down because it's expensive. The reason why we had that loss that I've referred to, we had those diamonds available for buying and on show on a very slow markup. I think we had reduced it to even up to 3% markup. We went to 2%. We went to give us whatever we want. Those diamonds stayed for 4.5 months without being bought. So we do have stock sometimes. Right now, maybe that's not true, but we've had stock and we've had people not being able to buy simply because the market was difficult. Now, the fact that our existence coincided with factory closing is now put that this is the reason. But if you go back to the days of DMDL, the argument was no one can buy it. It's too expensive and diamonds are not available in South Africa. That is why this committee decided and approved that we have legislation that actually stops that. So the linkage is there. Honorable Smith, I have a problem with linking them with reality. Then you talk about us being a passive purchaser. Now, as a board, this was a very difficult decision for us to take. Remember, I said that up till March 2009, we were in a situation where, one, we could not afford to have stock that would buy with the hope that would show the industry and the industry possibly would not buy, or to close shops because now there was absolutely nothing we had. So we understood this as a seriously interim measure because the way we look at our mandate as a state diamond trader is that it comes with two-sided sharp edges. On the one hand, we're supposed to stimulate local beneficiation. On the other hand, we're supposed to ensure that we operate in a profitable manner. Now, if we had focused on the only operating on the profitable manner, we were not going to live long enough to even begin to continue to sustain the industry for local beneficiation. So that is why we had an interim process of we may need to get to the point of facilitating access to diamonds of cutters and polishers who are willing to buy a closed parcel so that we are around for long enough to begin when the industry takes an upturn, because the risk of having stock staying and losing further amounts of money was something that we as a state diamond trader could not take a risk at. So yes, at the moment we may be seen as a passive facilitator, but the outcome is that there is somebody in the building where we operate who is able to have diamonds to cut and polish through our facilitation, and I think that meets our mandate of being and enhancing beneficiation. Not the best way, but the way that allows us to be able to be around long enough to continue to focus on what we have to do. How do we make a profit? This is why I was saying that we've realized that we may need to look at whether we are forced to make a profit. And the profit is not an extraordinary amount. The profit is just enough for us to pay our rent and our life. But we started with a model that proposed that we would have up to 7% margin. This has reduced and gone down. We've had diamonds where we sold them at 1% margin, just so that you are able to make sure that we make the diamonds accessible. And we believe that if we could do away with the margin at all and make sure that we know that the operations of the SDT are taken care of so that we can focus on our mandate, our idea is that maybe we should focus on a developmental state diamond trader rather than a profit-making state diamond trader that has to put a margin up to be able to survive and continue to sell that. And there are costs, by the way, that are sometimes hidden that we have to pay. The law requires that every time a producer has a production out, we must go and view the goods. And when we view the goods, now remember all the mines are not in Johannesburg, sadly, and we are in Johannesburg. So we go view the goods. The GDV sets the price of the 10%, and we enter into a situation where the producer is not happy with the price. We need to pay for the cost of having an independent IDV that's going to actually agree. So all those costs, somebody is going to pay for that. And we are saying as the SDT that perhaps we need to look at a better funding model that allows us to do that without allowing the customer at the end to carry that cost. Because now, once it's done that, we need to put a margin on that. So what makes the SDT a profitable organization? Right now, I think that it is the current model that's been approved, and it is the model that we're engaging the shareholders to say that perhaps we should be released on worrying about profit and be facilitators of beneficiation for the betterment of the country.
Can we come back to this matter of the fair market value? Particularly the determination thereof. You're talking of the GDP, which I take it to be the government diamond valuator. And there's also the coming into the picture of the independent, you know, valuator. Why must therefore the state diamond trader be responsible for those costs? Because the dispute shall have arisen from the seller. In this instance, you know, a miner who basically is putting up his or her 10% run of mine. But why must you pick up the tab in terms of the resolution of that dispute? And when you respond to that, you make mention of the challenges and resistance from some of the producers. I have read in some of the literature that there are court cases that are pending, particularly on this issue of the dispute on the value, in terms of trading between yourselves. And in this is not more from the purchasers, but on the part of the producers that must, put up their production, that must offer their production to yourselves. Can you clarify us on that so that we can then understand? Maybe that will answer some of the questions in terms of the profitability and otherwise. Around the question of the fair market value.
Okay.
You are not worried, or you should not worry about profit. Something like that. What is the idea then of running that business if you're not going to make profit? And maybe this is linked to what you also said about the government state diamond trader, something like that. What does that mean? The government state diamond trader. And also, you said something about DBS pulling out. Was pulling out to where? And if you can explain more about this diamond and Habrod and us.
Okay.
honorable members have noted you, but these are just, I take it, follow-up questions to these specific responses. We're trying to tease out some of the issues. Otherwise, you remain noted.
Thank you. I will ask the CEO.
Thank you. I will ask the CEO, I think, to explain the legal steps of determining fair market value. Then I will come in to discuss the issue about the cases and where is the problem. So if the CEO could just take us through, this is how, in terms of the Act, we are meant to reach an agreement on fair market value, where the government, the GDV comes in, and when the IDV kicks in.
Thank you, Chairperson. Section 59D2 indicates, provides that all the producers have got to declare their production cycles and then obviously invite the state diamond trader to then go and do an inspection of their 100% and then to allow the state diamond trader to select the required percentage. But also, as they declare and as they present their 100%, they have to then state the fair market value of such 100%. Now, when you move from, then what we do is that we do the inspection, we do the selection, which has got to be a representative sample, therefore the run-of-mine issue. And obviously, from that fair market value and the inspection, we do our valuation. And so at that point, you have therefore two values, the fair market value as stated by the producer, the state diamond trader's value, and then the law says that the government diamond valuator has got to come in to verify the values or the prices placed by the producer on those diamonds. And so the GDV then comes in and does that procedure. And if there is agreement between the prices, between prices stated by the GDV and the producer, then the state diamond trader still has the choice. It's still may buy or not buy, depending on whether we see value and, you know, we can forward sell the goods to our clients. But if there is no agreement between the values placed by the GDV and the producer on those goods, then the regulator now has got to come in again. I mean, the regulator also employs the GDV, but has got to come in with a process of selecting or finding an independent diamond valuator. That process, when we engage in it, through that process, the state diamond trader becomes a bit of a bystander, because then the selection of such an independent diamond valuator happens between the regulator and the producer. They agree on that value, on the independent valuation, and then it carries on. It is in the law that that's how it's supposed to happen, Section 59B. And also, the payment or the responsibility for the costs of such independent valuation, the law says it's to be, you know, borne by the producer and the state diamond trader equally. So that's how we end up, Chairperson, coming in to then pay also for that valuation that's done by the independent valuator, but not the government valuator. We don't pay for that cost, but we pay for, you know, any activity that is undertaken by an independent valuator who gets appointed between the producer and the regulator.
Then I would like just to take it from there then and say that the reason then why we are having some challenges that are leading to court costs, in spite of the law being very clear. And there was an argument, I think, a few years ago when some of the producers felt that the fair market value should not or cannot be determined by the GDV. It should be determined through a tender process. and the challenge that I think the committee had of that, and I think we also as the SDT agree with that, is that the tender process is not does not determine the actual value of the diamond, because you get people from outside South Africa or people who have got other diamonds to mix with this one, and therefore the value is not the accurate value of how much this diamond is. That is why the Act says that the value must be stated at the time that you deal with the production. So we still have resistance from producers first, who insist that the tender process will be what will determine what we term fair market value. And what then happens is that when we go to view the goods, they refuse to give a price of the 100%, and they will await the tender, because after we've taken the up to 10%, they are then able to go and put their goods on tender, and then they come back after the fact to tell us that this is now the value of the goods, which is now determined based on the price that they received on the tender. So that's one. The second issue where we are then also getting resistance and lack of cooperation from producers is then when we follow the Act and there's no agreement about the value, we get to the point where we appoint the IDV. Now, it says very clearly that the IDV is the final arbiter, whatever the price that the IDV comes up with, and remembering that both the producer and ourselves would have agreed on who the IDV is. When that price is determined by the IDV of this is the price, we still get producers refusing to comply with what the IDV has determined. And we've got a problem with two particular producers in this instance who still refuse to comply with what the IDV has said, which in our view is a clear, blatant refusal to comply with the law, because you don't take the law to the process where you use the system that is stated in the law, and when you don't like the answer, then you say, no, I'm not happy. Well, then engaging with those producers, and I think the committee, we are going to take it as far as it has to go, because we believe that this is what the law as it stands requires us to do. So that is then where we have a problem, Chairperson, with regards to that matter. Other failures to cooperate with the state diamond trader and continuing fights that producers lost at the time that this law was developed includes, for example, resistance in just getting a simple timetable. When is your production? Because we need to know when that production is coming up so that we have people there to look at the 10% and agree. So we struggle even at that point in getting the timetable. So there's a very serious laser fair attitude to assisting and implementing the law and assisting the state diamond trader to meet its mandate. So that, Chairperson, in a nutshell comes from that.
And just lastly on that very same issue, some of these producers maintain that both the GDV and the independent evaluator play somewhat of a mediation role. All they do is to peg the value in between the value from the state diamond trader and the value from the producer, basically trying to find a common ground instead of actually determining the value of the product. Is that fair or true?
Chairperson, I don't know whether if that was, let me go with the extreme and say that if that was to be true, that they find the value between. If I want to buy your car, it is more likely that the person that will arbitrate may agree with me that no, that is too much. And so the value, of course, is likely to be between the two values. So I'm trying to find out then what they see the GDV or the IDV to be doing wrongly. But let's leave the GDV for now and say then when we get to the IDV process, whether that person found a middle road or not, the fact is the law says once they've decided on that price. So you don't enter that game and then ready to actually
I don't know, control what the IDV says. You either say, I don't believe in that process, I'm not going to go through that. But the price is always going to be between what the estate demonstrator says and what the producer says. So that argument for me, I mean, there is no way they can find any other price except between the two prices. But the interesting thing, Chairperson and members, is that before the GDV used to be accused, this is where, before the days of the state diamond trader, where the valuing of diamonds had to do with tax and export thing, the GDV was accused of undervaluing the goods. That was the most thing. The GDV undervalued the goods. Suddenly, in comes the state diamond trader. Now the GDV overvalues. So we've got this, you know, where producers try to find whatever is best for them. So, no, Chair, we are mostly satisfied with processes. It doesn't mean that we agree sometimes with the IDV, we agree with the GDV, because sometimes as a state demonstrator, we fail to see the value that the GDV has seen. So it's not all the time that we come out laughing out of the assessment. We're sometimes not happy that we think that, okay, we won't be able to make money. We think he's made them a bit expensive, and sometimes the producers must understand that as well. Then going on to the honourable member's question that I said that we should not worry about profits. No, sir. I think we should not, as a state diamond trader, focus on profitability to the extent that we make the diamonds so expensive for people that need to buy. Our mandate, I think, should be focusing on beneficiation. And if we are looking at our profitability to the extent that we have to add a 6%, a 7%, or 8% margin, I think that will seriously threaten the overall goals of local beneficiation. Because it means that we're coming in as the middleman, and the middleman, the cost of the middleman is so expensive. So what I am saying is that perhaps a new funding structure that government could look at or explore is that we as a state diamond trader are focused on being a developmental state diamond trader. So we focus on this developmental aspect, and we know that we receive funding, so the salaries of the staff that are there are paid. We know that our rent will be paid so that we don't have to put markups on the goods that we make available. I'm not discussing totally the need for government to have returns, but I'm just saying that as a state demonstrator, if we're allowed to focus on making goods available, that would be better.
Okay, let's allow you. No, but the very nature of the governmental state you're talking about is the state that is gunning for profit. State that was doing profit. So now if at the same time that state wants to make profit, on the other hand, they are not very much interested. I say not very much interested in profit. What's the use of that?
Did you follow the question?
I think that I understand where the honourable member is coming from, and all I'm saying is that for us, we are feeling that our experience on the ground would our ability to meet the beneficiation strategy and goal of government would be seriously limited if we have to increase our markups for our survival. And it's a proposal. Government could come back, members could come back and tell us that no, continue with the profitability strategy. We've done it for 2 years, and we just feel that it provides a bit of constraints for us to fully meet the goals. So it's just a proposal. Then you mentioned the issue of De Beers pulling out. The contract service level agreement that De Beers gave the state was that they would allow us to use the resources that they had for the previous company called DMDEL, and they would give us the same stuff for a period which is coming to an end in October. We are getting close to that, and the idea in terms of that contract is that there has to be a renegotiation whether the state diamond trader buys the machinery or seeks an extension of the contract. So those are the issues that come up, but it was always going to be for a limited period to allow the state diamond trader to set up. And with regards to the issue of De Beers and Gaborone, I said earlier that it's difficult for me to comment because it's a private company that is in a foreign country that I'm not very clear about the details of what they're doing. So what I was referring to is just what I hear from the media and in the corridors of the diamond world. Gabon.
Okay. Can we now have Honorable Gale, followed by Honorable Matibela, and the other end, followed by Honorable Schmidt, Honorable Lucas. Let's take that to be the second part.
Thank you, Chair. My question has been covered when she was replying to Honorable Smith. It was about the selling the rough diamonds and sending them to India. I thought it was easier, but anyway, you have covered that. The next one, I'm sure I was outside when you were. I'm now in trading performance for the period April-September tonight. Second bullet, which says the board introduced trading on a pre-finance basis for a six-month period. Did you find that helping? You might have done that. You might have explained it, but I'm sure I was outside. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my is on the beneficiation. The aim of the state diamond is to address beneficiation. I was on in 2005. We went to Kimberley. There was a building there, which was under the provincial government. And I thought there, when we went there, that the State Trade Diamond was going to use that building for beneficiation. Because I think, if I'm not mistaken, if my memory still serves me well, that we said when we were there, we're talking about India. And when we went to India, they promised us that they could send somebody to come and train our people. And I think when we were there, we were agreeing about that building. Now I just want to know, when we talk about the diamonds, is it only for selling? The beneficiation is only people who are buying. Only those who are buying. There's nothing that you can do to help these people do something to polish and cut the diamonds here in South Africa, unlike just selling them as a state diamond trader. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Schmidt.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think I feel along the lines of what Mrs. Matibela is experiencing this morning. I was with on that same committee meeting, and the impression was created that we need the Act, we're going to ensure beneficiation, we're going to enforce beneficiation, we're going to use these buildings, we're going to employ people or have people employed. All we need is the Act, we're going to restructure the diamond industry, we'll force 10% from diamond companies. You know, a whole new scheme of things, schematic scheme of things. We opposed it, we're on record for opposing it, but nonetheless, that was the indication given. Today, I get the impression that we have a state diamond trader not being able to stand on his own two feet. Nothing has happened, or I can't say nothing has happened, but I mean, outside in the normal diamond industry, very little has happened in terms of making the beneficiation argument in terms of providing diamonds to those people who have not had access to diamonds before. So you're talking of a of a BEE component, of those kind of objectives, which I don't see any inkling, any trace, any notion, any. So my concern is basically, I understand there's been an economic crisis, but what is it that since promulgating that act or passing that act to Parliament 2-3 years ago, and which is now being taken on review and being asked to be set aside because of constitutional issues, what is it that the state diamond trader has done to actively facilitate access to diamonds to small polishers and cutters and those kind of individuals for which the act was intended for? The main purpose of the act was intended for, and what it seems to me, not even all the big diamond companies are being produced or being approached because the state diamond trader doesn't have the funding, it's not viable, it's not. So we've got a, with due respect, a white elephant, which to the industry, which means nothing to no one, except that it's a drain on the state funding.
Can you respond to the look? Oh, are you up, yes. Mr. Lucas?
Yeah. If I may. The whole idea was one brilliant idea. And I think if we look at what happened in India, India has taken, there was a special dispensation where they could get cheap diamonds, small ones, workable. And it worked over there. So what are we doing wrong? There is something that we are doing wrong. If we, and I'm saying by the first step that has been made, the state diamond trader has come out openly. And I think this is where I see a gap for some improvement to the situation. When we talk about the evaluator, the state diamond evaluator, I remember many years ago that that was a problem also, because the state diamond evaluator was working for some people, and it made it nice for those people. Therefore, you get an independent evaluator. Now the problem begins. Because these are the serious things that we want to look at them. But I would like to say that beneficiation is one of the things that we like to promote in South Africa. And one of the ways we thought was going to be an easy way and would be an example to the rest of the industry was diamonds. But unfortunately, it's happening at the wrong time. The way forward, I would like to suggest, is maybe we should re-look at the legislation. Let's re-look at this. Let us, now that we have been wiser, and see what we can do to this. Because at the time, there were a lot of hot heads. We all came up with ideas, and we were looking at it. We went to India. We came back, but we did not agree. All right. Some of the things we had to be persuaded to agree to, and hopefully it was going to work. So now that we've seen these things, I would say, Mr. Chairman, it is time that we re-look at this whole thing. And let us come up. We've grown up a bit, and we may make better suggestions to the way forward.
Can you respond to those questions?
Thank you very much. I'll take the first one regarding the trading performance that we had agreed to do trading on a pre-finance basis, and the question was, has it worked? I think I'd like to answer that yes and no. It has worked in that our finances look a lot better. We have less risk of losing more money by having goods on the market. But for me personally, as chairperson and as a person responsible to the shareholder and to yourself, I don't think that it is an alternative to the way that the state diamond trader has traded, because it compromises seriously our ability to attract new players who are not so confident about buying a diamond in a closed session, who still want that touch and feel and get the sense that this is what I'm buying. So we're never prepared to compromise that, because it means that only the old players who in their sleep can tell you that if it's that color and it's that shape, I want it. So I don't think that it's a good strategy long term, but it's a strategy that allowed us to deal with an interim challenging period, which I can assure members that had we not adopted that,
we would be talking now about the, we're closed, the AG would have closed us down for technical insolvency. So it was a way out of the situation. So, ma'am, your answer is yes and no. It is yes, it's made our bank balance look better and allowed us to trade. It is no, because it's not allowing us to attract new people and deal with the smaller guy who wants to come in and buy 3 or 4 stones and start his operation, especially if he's still not confident about the diamonds, the diamond industry. On the second one, the issue about Kimberley. Yes, there was a strategy, and we were informed when we started the board that in the long term, the board needs to look at relocating to Kimberley for purposes of setting up in Kimberley. But the shareholder, with our discussions with the shareholder, this was going to be a long-term strategy simply because all the equipment that you needed to run the State Diamond Trader was donated by De Beers in a building that was in Johannesburg. So the Kimberley option was always going to be an option when the State Diamond Trader is at this stance where we're able to buy our own machines and move, because De Beers gave us a building, staff that was located in Johannesburg, gave us machines that were located in Johannesburg. So all the facilities that we had were not in Kimberley, and for us to move to Kimberley would have meant that we needed to get new staff, to get new machines. So it is something that we constantly in our minds. In fact, what we as a board have decided to do is that every time we plan our in terms of engaging the public, we agree that we need to go throughout all the provinces and especially Kimberley, so that we're able to keep that contact with Kimberley. The building that the provincial government had availed for possible use still requires an entrepreneur, a diamond entrepreneur, who's still going to come and buy diamonds from the State Diamond Trader and say to us that this is where I want those goods. Sadly, in all our customers, I don't believe that we've had a person that has made a proposal that they would like to receive goods and cut and polish in Kimberley. So that is what happened. I think it was always going to be long training. But in terms of what do we do, what have we done as a State Diamond Trader to date to facilitate that? I said earlier that the State Diamond Trader is very concerned about the small players, and particularly the previously disadvantaged players. So there's ongoing, and when I say ongoing, the quarterly meetings that are reported on are over and above an open door policy that our CEO has, that anybody can come in and have discussions. What are your challenges? We have brought F&B on board to try and discuss with the small players how to get money to buy goods. We have IDC engaging with them to try and find a situation. We've got the Department of Mining Resources also engaging. We have taken a group in our initiatives as the State Diamond Trader and the department, a group of our customers to go and explore overseas markets, because the other point is that once they have the goods, you still have to have a market. And the markets that we have now are mostly with the established old guys who've been around for a long time. So we're also trying to open markets for them. We have ongoing information sessions with them. But at the end of the day, except for us opening our doors and saying that here's a diamond for free, we're not able to do that. They have challenges with finances. They have challenges with, as I said before, documents that allow them to trade. They've got challenges with equipment to cut and polish. So now we need to look at what the State Diamond Trader was intended to do, and I think manage the expectations of the committee and the people that were supposed to sell. It is not possible for the State Diamond Trader to make diamonds available on a pre-finance basis, as we've been asked by the small players. It is not possible for the State Diamond Trader to, they have asked us that just give me a stock for $2 million, and then as a start-up, I think you've got Cooler, you've got other organizations that are meant to do that, and we're not able to do that. So as far as possible, without losing sight of our mandate, we have tried to assist players. With regards to ensuring that the BEE players come on board, when we started getting customers for the State Diamond Trader, we said anybody that's in the diamond industry that wants to be a customer should come in, but within a year, we will not renew your ability to be a customer if you have not indicated to us that you are BEE compliant, or you are working, or you know, just fulfilling that role. We've extended that again and said that at the beginning of the financial year, to allow people to set up, we are going to be looking at that. So we've tried various ways of meeting the industry halfway. But at the end of the day, if members recall that this is about getting a diamond, cutting and polishing it, and selling it somewhere. Because most of them, actually, once they've bought, they were telling us that now they want to come and sell the polished goods to us. You sold me this diamond, Madam Chairperson. It is now 9 months. I want to bring it back to you, and I want my money because I cannot open the market. So this challenge that we have of beneficiation, honorable members, is a wider challenge. It's a bigger challenge. It requires a market. It requires finances. It requires ability to be in this industry, and it's not the easiest industry to be in. I have to come out and say that. Now, is it a white elephant draining the state resources? Not true. Because as we sit now here, we are not draining any state resources, as it happens. We are not draining any resources at all, because we are still operating on a profit basis where we've got to pay a prime plus two CEO to IDC for every amount of loan that we take. So we're operating on a purely commercial basis. So I don't believe we're a white elephant, and I don't believe we're draining state resources. And the proposal that we have, that possibly getting assistance from the state, I don't still think will make us a white elephant. I think it will make us facilitators of the mandate of the state to meet beneficiation. India, I agree, is a good model. It's an absolutely good model, but here's the problem. In South Africa, when we had these presentations to Parliament, which I also attended, we had the diamond cutters and polishers saying to members, and they could have had 10 Bibles if you'd given them, but saying to members that I can deal, I can cut any diamond. I just don't want any diamond to leave South Africa. All the diamonds are cuttable. I'm just starving for a diamond, and I can cut anything. We set up the state diamond trader. We ask everybody what types of goods do you want. The goods that customers of the state diamond trader say they want do not include what we call Indian goods. So no one, all those members that were here that could cut anything, just give me anything, I will take anything, have disappeared, honorable members. So we now have people that are cutting certain goods, and it's the larger goods, it is the goods that were called cuttable goods. This is why earlier on I had said that as a state diamond trader, because we buy run of mine, so we end up with those goods as part of our stock. We end up having paid for them. That we need to explore ways of how we can maybe have a change in legislation that allows us as a state diamond trader to get value, because then the people that buy those goods, they don't cut them. They use their quota to go and export them and make money in India. And as a board, we are saying that why can't we then be the ones that are going to take those goods out, that the market, maybe we put them for 9 months even, a year. And if they're not sellable by a South African buyer, we are allowed to access someone else who wants them, and the Indians do want them because they've got experience in cutting Indian goods. We then engage with the cutters and say, would you like to receive training in cutting Indian goods? No, the values are, the returns are too small. So there's not a shortage of initiatives to benefit from the Indian and the cutting. It's just that people don't think that is where their time. We're still exploring that, because we think that the ideal is to get to a situation where we cut everything in South Africa. We train people that will cut everything in South Africa. But in between that time, there's a proposal that we are feeling that perhaps we should be allowed them to be the ones that benefit from that, to actually bring back the money and make beneficiation vision a more feasible idea. The markets I've spoken about, that we continuously engage with our stakeholders to try and open markets for them. We've taken a group of women cutters and polishers on a 3-country visit overseas. They have had good feedback, and there may be some deals that will be cut, and we continue in terms of our mandate to engage with them.
Okay.
Okay. Honourable members, I think that should take care of our questions, but I think there are still some areas that we need to basically tease out further with this data manipulator. One is that I'm not yet convinced that the legislative requirement of the 10% of the run of mine is an unattainable goal. Apart from the problems of the global market situation, we still need to be informed more on what are the other impediments. Because when we look at your annual report, you have the capacity to inspect, for example, about 78% of the total production, which says to us that there is capacity on your part to can be able to undertake the work. But the downside is that you procure only 1%, which I think you attempted to explain. But also, let me ask you, whether do you know the process of the beneficiation strategy? Where is it now? The last we were informed was that it's at the cabinet level, and I think also operating, you know, within that vacuum in terms of policy direction might also cause some difficulty on your part, and we would need to fast track that. But assist us if you have any knowledge in terms of that. Now, you're saying that you would need some legislative changes. Fine, I think bring the proposals, but what is very important that must be kept, you know, clear in all our minds, that as a country we are in the process of building a developmental state. Part of that, you know, the imperatives thereof are that we need strong state organs. In this instance, we cannot effect transformation, both in terms of the development of the beneficiation industry in the country, as well as the transfer of skills, if we don't maintain the state diamond trader, you know, in operation. It might well be that instead of maybe allowing you to participate in the process of the export of the rough diamonds, we would might need to look at possibilities of increasing the levy for all the goods that would leave the country and not being beneficiated locally. It might be necessary for us to then look into that, but bring whatever, you know, proposals you have, but we need to remind you that we've got this. You see, in many instances, instead of changing the objectives of the country, sometimes what becomes necessary is the change of the system to work on the turnaround strategy, so that you fit in into the stated objectives of the country. For an example, you are basically complaining about funding situation, where you have ITC as your main funder at the moment, and you are talking about the steep interest rates that are being charged. Then the question that I think as a country we must pose, what is the mandate of IDC? Is IDC operating as a developmental finance institution, or is it operating as a profit motivated financial institution? Because there must be a distinction and difference between those two. You cannot have a situation where a financial institution that is set up through taxpayers' money then, you know, begins to operate in such a manner that defeats the objectives, national objectives of the country. We would need to then, you know, also engage with IDC. And I don't know, you haven't raised anything about the Development Bank of South Africa, whether we have approached them and what is their situation, whether also there are no other DFIs out there that you have approached. But of course, if your funding model is not clear, you will have difficulty in any of the institutions wanting to come out and assist you. And I think we still need to work out on this thing of the market value. You know, we need to re-clarify ourselves with your help precisely what is expected. Because this issue of court cases you are correctly pointing out that you can't participate in the process, and when the outcomes do not suit you, then you then, you know, cry foul and then take on, you know, the issue through other means, seeking other remedies. Either you are playing within the rules as defined, or you are outside of the game. We're a bit worried about the human resources development. You know, the pulling out of the beers. I don't know, you will tell us whether there are contingency plans that you have worked out with DBS, because that objective of the transfer of the skills has not yet been realized. And you were saying that it's not only DBS as the player in terms of the field that you are operating in, but what about the other players? What kind of role do they play in terms of, you know, assisting, you know, the state administrator in developing its own skills so that you are able to operate more viably? But all of this, I must say that when I look at your annual report, some of the governance issues are worrisome. You know, for instance, if you look at the pattern of the attendance of some of your members and some of your committees, someone would attend only 2 meetings out of about, 11 meetings. That doesn't demonstrate commitment and seriousness in terms of wanting to make the necessary contribution for this organization to move forward. And finally, the issue of this entity as a going concern. We cannot overlook the statements by the AG. I think apart from dissecting your financial statements, raising some concerns some of the procedures that he basically spoke about in your annual report, which we don't see a corresponding action. You have not spoken to that in terms of whether are you working on those areas that the Attorney General, although he did not qualify your statements, but there are concerns that the Attorney General raised in terms of the financial statements. But most importantly for us is this matter of this STD being, uncertain, and as far as it being a going concern. We can't overlook that. I'm not yet even sure myself as to what is it that you are doing, to turn around that situation. Because if this financial year, the AG's report is indicating these flickering red lights, in the following year, who knows, you might be forced to close shop. And therefore, that would be 10 steps backwards in terms of the realization of our national objectives. So it's around those areas that maybe not necessarily for now, but then when you come back, we would want to get absolute clarity so that we're able to then, together with yourselves, chart the way forward. Because I think one member asked here, what is it that we must do in order to then assist you in turning the situation around? But I think based on the questions that were asked and the engagement that you had with the members, that gives you a direction that there are concerns. And concerns that also confirm your own concerns. And therefore, we would need then to find a way forward. I would like us to work on these areas and other areas that you shall have identified, so that when we meet next time around, you are able to then talk about the way forward in relation to strengthening instead of even thinking about, you know, closing shop or maybe changing, you know, the objectives of the state administrator. We need to strengthen it so that it operates and assists us to realize our goals. With that, honorable members, can we not take tea? And after tea, we take the regulator and hear what role have they played in this situation. Can we take a 10-minute tea break and come back? Allow the South African diamond and precious metal regulator to take us through their presentation. Over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chair and all members of the committee. My name is Billy Manuku. I am the Deputy Chair of the South African Diamond and Precious Metals Regulator.
Hold on. Honorable members, the meeting is just before we resume, I noticed that you have been joined by a couple of new faces. Some of the people sitting on the side there, can you introduce yourself, starting with you, madam?
My name is Maneka Zabo. I'm the Chief of Staff in the Ministry of Mineral Resources. Thank you.
Come up. Come.
I am Llewellyn Delport. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Transex Group, one of the producers.
Okay, I'm Mervyn Carstens, Mervyn Carstens, Operations Director for Transex.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and all members. My name is Billy Manuku. I am the Deputy Chair of the South African Diamond and Precious Metals Regulator. I wish to extend the chairperson's apology for not being able to attend the session. I'm in his stead. I have a team next to me. On my left-hand side, the acting CEO, Mr. Simon Kosana, who will be running the presentation. And on my right-hand side, we've got the Chief Financial Officer of the regulator, Mr. Mteta, who will also be doing the presentation. I'll take this opportunity to hand over to the acting CEO, Mr. Simon Kosana, to present to the committee. Thank you, Chair. We have distributed. Okay, thank you. Over to you, Simon.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, for giving us this opportunity. And thank you, members of the committee. The South African Diamond and Precious Metals Regulator was established in 2007. Its mandate lies in the 3Xs that I've listed below, which is the two amended Diamond Acts, as well as the Precious Metals Act. We also, in collaboration with the South African Revenue Services, facilitate the collection of the export levy in terms of the Export Levy Act. As I've already mentioned, the regulator is almost 2 years in existence. The regulator was the former Diamond Board, and its mandate was extended with the Precious Metals Act. We also now not only administrate the diamond trade, but also administrate the precious metal, which is platinum and gold. The functions of the regulator, we issue licenses for diamond and precious metals, namely the diamond dealership licenses. We issue the beneficiation research for people that are doing researches. We also administrate import and export of diamonds and other permits that we issue. On the precious metal side, we issue the refining licenses. In the refining licenses, we also not only focus on the refining, as people know, refiners. We also cover the smelters. All the smelters in the mines, we now license them. We also issue a jeweler's permit, the beneficiation licenses. We also administrate important export permits for precious metals. On the control side of import and export of diamonds, we ensure compliance
on rough diamonds, polished diamonds, as well as synthetic diamonds. All the diamonds entering and leaving the country, we have to control them. We also monitor license conditions, all the licenses that we've issued in terms of dealership beneficiation. On a regular basis, we monitor whether there is compliance with the conditions of those licenses. In facilitating the collection of export levy, all the export data are leaving the country before we export any commodities. We ensure that SARS has collected its levies. So no diamond leaves the country without the payment of the levy, unless there's an exemption. We also issue kimberley process certification to ensure that the diamonds that are exported are legitimate. And also the those that are entering the country are also from the participating countries. We also participate in the kimberley process on an annual basis, where we participate in the process of a working group for monitoring all those participants that are in the kimberley process certification, that they comply with the minimum requirements of the kimberley process. We also participate in a working group of diamond experts where information is shared on best practices as far as classification and other matters relating to diamonds. We also facilitate the selling and buying of diamonds. When we open the new diamond export and exchange center, we receive diamonds from the local producers as well as the local individual dealers. Those diamonds are displayed at the export and exchange center so that it can facilitate the buying and selling within the local people or local businesses in South Africa. At no fee. We also value diamonds that are presented by producers to the state diamond trader to ensure that they are market related. We ensure that all the producers submit to us on an annual basis their production cycles so that we can ensure that there is a smooth presentation and also evaluation of those diamonds without the disruption of their schedule. We also value diamonds that are confiscated by police, the illicit diamonds that people are dealing with in the country. We ensure that those diamonds are evaluated, and that also we also provide testimony in court and evidence to ensure that the law takes its course. And we also ensure that all those diamonds that have been confiscated, when they are sold by the South African bodies, are sold at a market-related value, so that those costs are inherited by the police. Not cost, but the benefits are inherited by the police. We also promote beneficiation of diamonds and precious metals. We've got a research section where we look at the best practices in the world, what is it that they are doing that the others can benefit from. We look at opportunities. Just an example, the gold, most of the gold in South Africa was producing PFAS, which people could not afford. We did a research that it is possible to have a very small sort of a pass delivered, but that people can be able to purchase for their investment or whatever. So that has made beneficiation to increase in the country in that regard. We are also looking at other issues where we can be able to improve on beneficiation with diamonds and precious metal. Our achievement. Last year in July, we appointed the government diamond evaluator. Previously, this services was run by a subcontracted diamond evaluator. Now we've got our own diamond evaluators, which are appointed on a permanent basis that are rendering services, as I've already mentioned, to various stakeholders. In the previous year, we evaluated illicit diamonds that I've already mentioned that were confiscated by police worth 1.3 million. And we also provided the evidence in court where some criminals were convicted due to that those offenses. We issued about 1,009 new diamond licenses during the 2008 transitional period.
which was a very good achievement. We issued 89 precious metal licenses. As you are aware, the transitional period for precious metal ends in June 2009. We are yet to give the figures next year of what new licenses in precious metals have been issued. We evaluated and verified diamonds offered to the state diamond trader worth $24 million. This is not only the diamond that the state diamond trader purchases, but it's what we service that we've rendered in that regard. It depends whether diamonds are affordable to them and all that, but we have to, in terms of our legislation, to value those diamonds. We facilitated through our diamond and export exchange center for local purchase of diamonds at this worth $77 million. These diamonds were bought by our local business people at the diamond exchange center, which is a very good benefit for the channel business. We serviced about 1,200 viewers.
What is this? The DEC.
It's Diamond Export and Exchange Center. It's a center where people come in to submit their diamonds so that people can be able to buy. It's more like a market where you submit your diamonds, people can be able to view them, they can be able to purchase them. You set up your own reserve price, the people will bid, and the highest bidder will buy the diamonds. So it is a benefit in the sense that all South Africans are allowed to participate in the diamond exchange center, which was not the case previously. So it's an open market. Anybody who wants funds can get into the diamond exchange center and purchase the diamond for local development. But only the license, not only the license, not the illegal, or just members of the public, just only the licensed people that can enter. We inspected 637 business activities for compliance. These include the new businesses that applied, also the business that existing. We just enter into any premises and ensure that the people comply with the requirements of their license. This is a routine that we do on an annual basis. Our challenges. The Diamond Amendment Act has been challenged on a number of cases. We had to defend these cases, and we still got two pending cases that are still at the court that we still need to defend. Certain clauses in the Act itself are being challenged, so we have to defend the Act so that we can be able to carry our mandate. We also experience problems with the implementation of the legislation. The legislation per se had unintended consequences in certain areas. Just to make an example, when you import diamonds for research purposes, the diamonds will attract VAT. Normally, when people import diamonds, they import diamonds for research purposes only, and these diamonds can also be exported back to where they're coming from. But when the diamonds are supposed to leave the country, you've got to follow the processes of any business people who's got to send them varieties and all those kind of things. And those diamonds also attract the levy. So those are the challenges that we're facing with the legislation. It's just one of that I can mention. But there are a lot of them that had unintended consequences. The diamond was also, especially the diamond industry, was affected, as the chairperson of the state diamond trade has alluded to. The industry was severely affected by the economic downturn. When we look at our transaction that we conducted in 2007, we conducted about 4,000 transactions. Now it dropped to about 3,000, so we can see that almost 1,000 transactions were affected. To us, it
indicates that the business has really gone down. It is about 22% of the business went down. The other challenge that we are facing is access to funding, especially for the emerging and small players. They are willing to participate in an industry, but it is difficult for them to be able to purchase goods because of lack of funding. And in this regard, the financial institutions are reluctant to finance the small players. The other problem is access to rough diamonds. Whereas the small players also want to participate, but the problem that they're facing is that the diamonds in which they are packaged at our export exchange rates are not really affordable to most of them. Because it's not two stones, but it can be two big stones. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's big parcels that cannot be able to bid. Even if they bid, they cannot be able to match the guys that have got big pockets or deep pockets. It's still a problem that we're faced with. The other problem is access to markets. Small players can cut and polish diamonds. They are very excellent polishers. But when it comes to markets, they are also squeezed between the big players and the buyers in general. And they end up selling their goods at a very big discount. So I think these people need to be assisted so that they can be able to access the market openly and compete with the big players. The other problem that the State Diamond Trader has already mentioned is the dispute on fair market value of diamond offers to State Diamond Trader. It has been a big challenge. Our GDVs are putting the value, which is disputed by producers. We engage the services of an independent valuator, which we feel is an arbitrator, which must make a final determination. The IDV shall fix the price. But even when the price is fixed, there will still be dispute. People don't agree to such a fixed price. So there are pending court cases regarding that. So the matter will be heard in court, and we'll see what the court decides on the matter. It's a big challenge that we're faced with. It's not only one dispute. It can be one, two, three disputes. Sometimes they end up settling. Sometimes, as I've already said, it can be a court case. Sometimes disputes are not settled, finally. The other challenge that we're facing is the refining of illegal gold. Illegal gold coming from illegal mining. And this gold finds itself in the refineries. Sometimes it finds itself in the jewelers. We are working closely with the police. We are providing police information. In terms of the refining and other precious metal licenses, the license holders are supposed to submit information on a quarterly basis of what they've refined, what they've sold, and all those kind of things. We see some spikes in some of the information that they are submitting to us, and we are letting the police that there's something fishy in this particular business, and police need to investigate them. But it's the police intelligence that can be able to solve the problem, because it's such a difficult thing. You find it very difficult to find where the gold is coming from. So it's something that needs police intelligence to be able to solve the problem. For us, we're doing our work, we're submitting information to the police. It's up to the police to take the matter forward. With those slides, I wish to thank the members of the committee. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Does that conclude your presentation?
No. No, Chair, only in terms of the annual report. The CFO is here to speak to the financial.
Let him take us through.
CFO?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like the chairman indicated earlier on, that members in the House may have had time to look at the annual report, the financials, and so on. To avoid wasting time, repeating what has already been given to members, we decided to indicate on the issues raised by the Office of the Auditor General two steps that have been taken to try and rectify any weaknesses that were reported. We are going to start off by looking at item number 8 under the report of the Auditor General. And just to repeat that, although we did not get a qualification, but there were issues that needed to be addressed. Well, item number 8, I don't have to say much about that because it's just a confirmation of the process of accounting system that we need to use. But on item number 9, where the Auditor General found out that among the consultants that we appointed, they felt that the proper processes were not followed. And that was basically when we appointed a firm of auditors to conduct our internal audit functions in terms of the requirements of the KFMA. We had an unfortunate situation where our internal auditor resigned at short notice and leaving a lot of tasks not completed. So in trying to fulfill the requirements of the Act in as far as continuous internal audit function is concerned, we had to take steps to appoint another audit firm immediately to continue with the internal audit function. What we did there, we just approached three reputable audit firms for their bids, which they did. Then out of that, we made a selection. But unfortunately, the Auditor General felt that we should have followed due process in terms of the supply chain management policy and the federal regulations whereby we are required to advertise in the government bulletin and in the newspapers and give respondents time of up to 21 days before we close the tender. That should be corrected because the current contract expires at the end of March, when then we are going to follow due process. Item number 11, we were requested by our principal, then known as DME, to assist them with opening an account in which funds requested from the general public could be donated. And we are obliged by opening a separate bank account for those funds to be made available. But now the Auditor General feels that we should have obtained approval from National Treasury to do that. Although we did open a separate revenue fund, a separate bank account, which to us was equivalent to the revenue fund as required in terms of the Treasury regulations. But the Auditor General feels that still the approval from the National Treasury was supposed to be obtained. But that account has since been closed down and all the funds taken out of that account used for the purpose they were donated, and that account shall no longer continue. And then on the quorum of our audit committee, at the beginning of when the regulator was formed, it was unfortunate that members that were appointed by the minister to serve on the board were not of such a number that they could form the quorum or the audit committee, coupled with the fact that unfortunately there was none of them who had financial expertise, which required the audit committee to approach the board for permission to recruit additional members who have got the necessary financial experience from the public sector to come in and assist us. Although the first two or three meetings did not have the required quorum in terms of our audit charter, that has been addressed as well. Our meetings now are operated on a full quorum. And then there comes the issue of one of the audit committee members who, while serving on the committee, had his company assisting us with some of the audit issues and financial issues, which, according to the other, again, the proper processes according to him were not followed to the letter, although that member concerned had declared his interest by completing the form that is available to all the members serving on the board, saying that there is an assignment that he was doing on behalf of the regulator. Net assignment has since been finalized, and he's not his company is not doing that work anymore. And then under other key governance issues, item number 2. There was funds transferred from our sector, funds transferred from the regulator to MINTEC, because we have a joint venture in developing a fingerprinting project, which aims at assisting the regulator through MINTEC to be able to identify illegal diamonds coming to the country from the neighboring countries. This is in pursuance of the United Nations resolutions. In dealing with illegal diamonds into South Africa, because it is posing a serious danger that if a lot of diamonds coming from outside are entering our borders illegally, South Africa can eventually be suspended from participating in the diamond community. So we need to have a scientific method to deal with that sketch that requires a lot of money. This matter was debated, and the board agreed that we can invest in this project. I understand it is available in Australia and Canada already. But again, National Treasury or Minister of Finance was supposed to give his approval. But steps have been taken to approach National Treasury and Minister of Finance to ratify this transaction. Item number 3, members who have got the in position of our report will note that the report of the Auditor General was not signed or was not written Auditor General like they normally do, which they took it up as an issue. But then they gave us later their opinion with the same report which they had signed. It's just that when we got their preliminary opinion, we did not have much time, because we were trying to be on time to deliver the annual report to the Parliament for the 31st of August for tabling in terms of the requirements of the Act. So it took longer for the Auditor General to release their final opinion, and then when they released it, printing had already been done. But this matter has been discussed with them, and they've issued us now with the same report, but with their signature. And item number 6, bullet 1, I'm only going to concentrate on issues where there's a tick under a no. Like we indicated earlier on, that the audit committee, if you look at the annual report, there were up to 5 meetings that were conducted. But the first 3, unfortunately, did not have the number of members that are required in terms of the audit charter, which now has been addressed. And also, I think the second bullet also is about that issue, and it has been explained there. I think also all those issues are dealing about the same issue, so everything has been addressed. Eh? And then also on item number 8, the issue of the risk assessment that is required to be reviewed annually. We had the risk assessment done under the old Diamond Board, but had to be updated to include the risk that is faced now under the precious metals regulator as well. That has been done, and it's in the process of being reviewed by the board for final approval. Well, what is there under item number 9 is not quite specific on what they are referring to there, but I think it also relates to the issue of risk, which is a main issue that we need to sort of like focus on mainly to ensure that our entity is not going to find itself into another difficulty. And same applies to item number 11 as well. So it's also about risk, which has been addressed then and is continuously being monitored for any emerging risk that we may find out of safety. Well, if one looks at our previous year financial reports, you'll find that a lot of things that were raised previously have substantially been addressed, and we are still in the process of addressing whatever comes up with new challenges. And then on the performance information reporting, this is still a new topic where we are required now to first prepare a strategic plan and our objectives and the targets. Quarterly, we have to tell the minister out of those targets how many have we achieved at what cost, which I think is fair. But we are also still undergoing some training from the Office of the Auditor General itself. It has decided that because there is so much confusion on the issue, that they are going to assist us in helping us understand what format should we use so that we are all our reports are touching on sort of like similar issues. We had a meeting with them last week where they called, I think, public entities from the Gauteng region, outlining to us what we must do from now onwards. It's something that now the regulator is looking at. But I'm sure in our next audit, we are not going to find this concern coming up again. And then I would like to look at point number 18, which is about performance appraisals for staff, which is conducted regularly. Previously, we had borrowed the process or procedure that is being used by our principal, that is the Department of Minerals and Energy. But the auditor says that we have to develop our own in-house policy, so that then they can look at it and see if we comply with it to the data. And that's what we have done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There you have it, honorable member. Questions, demands, engagement with the report. I note Honorable Makakula, Honorable Matibela, so far, Honorable Lucas. Let's go with that first round. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Jacob, my question is just on the audit. He said there was a post, and then the person leaves them, the audit leaves them. And then they go this of getting the tender, making the quotations. The question is, why they do that? Why they know the normal process? But in such amount, you can't just go to the quotation process. You're supposed to go to the tender process. Another question. You said the Auditor General look at that and pinpoint and say, no, this was not that color. And then you said, no, it's fine because you're going to solve the problem. A tender process, a good tender process will be happening. Question is, there is a post of the internal audit that is there, approved, and it's no more there. Instead of closing that market, you go to this tender process again, trying to solve the problem. Just, I want to know that, are you really want to solve the problem, or are you making the problem worse? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, Chairperson, the financial statement is really confusing. There's a lot of wrongs here. You don't know which one to take and which one to believe and which one not to believe. A lot of things here are done wrongly. There's money that was given to 10 million, which was given to Mintec. But at the same time, it wasn't done in a correct way. I just don't know how, why are these things not done. Now, this statement or report that we are getting, I don't know how are we going to deal with it as a committee. Because it's a year ending annual report that we have to deal with it. It's now and no more. So I just don't know, Chairperson, what to say about this. It's really confusing. Maybe I'm the one who's getting confused. The other people are correct, but with me, it doesn't occur well. When they spoke about small parcels of gold which should be made, are those small parcels not going to be a good way of using the illegal people to deal with that small gold parcels which they're taking? And the other one is the legislation. I would like the presenter to tell us which part of the legislation is loose, so that we must know where to tighten the legislation. Thank you, Chairman.
Do you want to look at? Yeah, just a comment, really. You know, with the challenges, the refining of illegal gold, it's a bit of a concern, because we went through the process and we looked through it, and then we were told that it's in the hands of the SAPS, and so that's the situation. But the question is, you have the Kimberley process with diamonds. You should identify the source of the product. Now, with the gold, can you not determine where it does the gold originate from?
Honorable Charlie and the Honorable Colin.
Yes, is this the oil town report?
Yeah, well, the annual report is here, and this is audited. Here we are just taking only the issues that need to be discussed. We are just summarizing out of this analysis.
That's why you say you don't have it signed.
Yeah, this is one way we are saying the audit opinion here is not signed by the Auditor General, and that matter, and they gave us a signed one after the annual report had been produced, because there is a deadline in terms of the CFMA, the annual report.
The signed one is not here.
Sorry?
The signed one is not here.
No, the signed one is not here, but we've got it.
Can you
press your... I suggest we don't accept until they bring a signed
Bonita's report, because we are wasting time if we discuss a report that is not defined by the Bonita. It's a waste of time.
Okay,
thank you very much, Chairperson. Two quick questions from me for clarity. One is on the illegal gold. I just want to establish from them as to how do they establish that this is illegal gold. That would be the first. The second one would be on the irregular expenditure, where the 890,000 rents was incurred on the tender process. My question there will be as to who's going to be accountable for this irregular expenditure. That would be my two questions. Thank you.
Let's flag the proposal from Honorable Charlie, and in flagging it, clarify to us whether this report is similar or the same to the one that is signed, which is not before us. And then immediately after clarifying that, you respond to the questions raised, and we will take it from there.
Okay. Now, the report is that the defined version is exactly the same as this one, but it was not given to us electronically. It was a hard copy. This one, the reason why we responded to this one here is because it was emailed to us. So if it's emailed to us, it would not have their signature. The one that has the signature is a hard copy. So that's why it was easy for us to go into the system, create a space next to their comments where we can answer to that, and then reproduce it accordingly. But we could flex it at any time to the chairman to prove to him that the signed version is there. There is no difference. Everything is exactly. You can check it out, and if you find any discrepancy or disparity, you can even call us back here. We can come and prove to you that there is nothing here that has been either withheld or changed. We are not allowed to do that. There is no issue about that one. It's exactly the same. It's only that the one that we got from them electronically, they couldn't sign something on the computer.
Okay.
The first one on the appointment of the audit firm. You must remember that an auditor is a watchdog. I mean, he has to be there all the time. And there were times in the past when we didn't have an auditor, we picked up a lot of problems. And also any time when the auditor left, and the appointment of the first auditor was proper, the process was followed, but it takes time to advertise into newspaper, give them 21 days to respond. Thereafter, go through the selection process. Thereafter, shortlist. Thereafter, interview, and thereafter, give them time to serve notices where they are working. So that one was done properly at the beginning, but this time around, this person that we have worked so hard to appoint resigned, and he hasn't done much work. I think the work he had done was about 30% of what was expected. Now, we have got year end in March, the person resigns when we break for the recess in December. Now, that's when we come back in January, we have got no auditor. Now, we look at the options. Are we going to follow the process again of looking out for another auditor which could take us anything up from April? Mind you, our financial year end is March. The best thing is to approach auditing firms to give us one of their auditors to do the work under contract. We pay them accordingly. And then once the contract comes to an end, it is coming to an end at the end of March, then we are in the process already. We have started now looking for an auditor. The process is underway, but it takes a long time. That's why we started now. So it come end of the existing contract, we have an auditor that can take over immediately. it's a long process, unfortunately. So by appointing a firm that can make an auditor available after the bid has been awarded, first of all, we are covering ourselves in that when you appoint a firm, either their auditor that is doing our work resigns, they can be sent someone else the following day. That's an advantage. But if you employ, the person can come and work for a month or 2 months, resign again. Then you've got to follow the whole process of 4 months again looking for another one. See, this is it's a little bit more expensive than keeping your own, but you know that there is a continuous service. That is what we have heard up to now, continuous service. Because an auditor can be off sick, can go and leave, they send someone else. That's an advantage. On the issue of the 10 million rand, that investment is important. We are talking here about illegal diamonds and all those things. It poses a serious danger to the country if we are not doing anything to be able to establish the diamonds that we are cutting and polishing in this country. Are they all from our mines? Because in the past, the Kimberley Process Certification Scheme, which South Africa was one of the founding members of the scheme, it started here in South Africa. The whole world is learning from South Africa as to how to manage the scheme, because it's a big worry. Although wars in Africa have sort of like subsided, there are no black diamonds anymore. But there is still a lot of illegal diamonds. I can mention, for example, our neighbor Zimbabwe. There has been reports that a lot of Maranga diamonds find their way into South Africa illegally. But how do you go to court to prove that these diamonds are not South African diamonds if you don't have a scientific method that has been tested and proved that it can be relied on? So we've got to start now trying to protect our own industry by making sure that illegal diamonds coming into this country are properly licensed or they've got all the legal papers that they need to have. That's the reason why the 10 million rand, after the board discussed it, they felt at least we are doing something to make sure that in future we protect the interests of this country. I can't remember what other, but I think the other question was about the refinery. Okay, the 890 relates to that appointment of the firm for the internal auditor. They say it was not properly approved because the process was not properly followed. That money was paid to the audit firm to do the work. They've done the job, they've given us all the reports, the audit chairman has looked at those reports. But when they were looking at how were they appointed, that's when they said, no, this thing was short-circuited. It was supposed to be allowed to take the full process. That's what it amounts to. The bulk of this money went for the internal audit function.
Okay. Does that exhaust the list of questions asked so far?
No.
Okay.
My part, just...
Thanks, Chairperson. My part to Honorable Member, I think it's Matibela. Small parcels, Madam, for points of clarity, the parcels I was talking about is not gold parcels, it's diamond parcels. In gold, we don't deal with parcels, only in diamonds. Parcels are made smaller so that people can be able to afford them. When parcels are big, it means they're expensive and people cannot be able to afford them. But what we're trying to do as a regulator is to encourage, especially the small producers, to make their parcels smaller so that people can be able to afford them. We've already made inroads in this regard that some of the producers have already started the process of making parcels smaller so that people can afford them, instead of bulking them. Some have accepted that as long as those parcels are going to be bought, they are prepared to make them smaller. Coming to the legislation, you mentioned that which part of the legislation is loose, which needs to be tightened. If you look at Section 59, it is a very loose part of the legislation. As I mentioned, that when we engage the IDV must be a final arbitrator and fix the price. But the Act itself doesn't say that. Section 59B of the Diamond Amendment Act. It doesn't say that the determination made by the independent valuator is final and parties must accept it. It doesn't say that. It just says he shall fix the price, and it leaves that debt. Which to us is very loose. It must give us teeth that when we engage an IDV, the judgment or the evaluation that is going to make on that particular parcel is final, and parties cannot walk away from the final price fixed by him. That's what the legislation to say. And the matter must never be taken to court, because if it goes to court, it defeats the whole purpose. The other that very same section, lose the procedures. There are no regulation sort of backing up that particular section. There are no time frames, which is very important to us. We're talking with millions of friends, and people need to go into that transaction and finalize as soon as possible. But now the process drags because people don't want to agree. And for us, it's very important that when there's a dispute, it must say how many days must the other party respond, how many days must we take to appoint the IDB, how many days must the party agree to a final settlement. It's loose then. I'm just mentioning one of the sections that is giving us headaches, but I think there are a lot of them. When we present to the Department of Mineral Resources, we'll specifically mention those sections that are giving us headaches, and also the recommendation that we will make that should be included in terms of the section or in terms of the regulations and all those kind of things. The other thing that I need to mention, to save costs for the state diamond trader, the so-called IDVs, it's not a regulated industry. They charge whatever they feel. They're very costly, and I think we need to regulate them that they should not charge exorbitant. That's the problem moment. Some minimum fees, they say 80,000, whatever the value of the goods are. Some, they say a certain percentage of the goods, and that's where they can reap the benefits, because the more expensive the goods, the more money they're going to make. To us, it's something that we need to regulate that. This is how the goods should be, the rates should be determined. There I find that there's a loose section in the Act which we need to tighten. Responding to Honourable Member Lucas, unfortunately, is not here. Determining the source of gold, illegal gold. There's a police unit in Pretoria called the Forensic Unit. The Forensic Unit in Pretoria, it is a legal requirement of all the gold mine producers to submit their samples of gold to that unit. Those samples are fingerprinted. When you get gold from that particular mine, you immediately take it to forensics, they will tell you the source of gold, where it's coming from. We've had some discussion with the forensic unit that what has happened at the problem moment is only the producing mines that have submitted samples. They are all, in fact, some of the gold is in mine in old and defunct shafts, especially in Mpumalanga, which mines were closed years ago. We're talking with the forensic unit that they should also take samples from those particular defunct shafts so that we can immediately know where the gold is coming from. Because at the present moment, most of the gold or some of the gold is coming from those defunct shafts. So it's important that we also fingerprint them so that we can be able to know where the source is. Now, coming with a scheme that is similar to Kimberley process for fingerprinting of gold. This is part of the project that we want to engage with Mintec. Once Mintec has finished this fingerprinting of diamonds, we are looking at the process where it's not only going to be a South African fingerprint, it should be a SADC started finger pointing where the whole gold coming from the African countries is going to be finger printed. Because it's not only going to end with South African illegal gold, it's also going to be a SADC problem. And some of the gold that we find in the refineries, it's imported. We're getting a lot of application where people are putting application to import gold from Africa. And it's going to be a problem if we don't tighten the screw before things go out of way. We need to be sure where the gold is coming from, because some people say it's coming from this particular country, whereas it might not be coming from that particular area. So we must be sure if it's coming from that particular area, it's fingerprinted. We know it's coming from Ghana, it's Ghana, Tanzania, it's Tanzania. A similar scheme, similar to Kimberley process, must be also introduced in as far as gold is concerned. To another member, is it, I don't know what is the right name, Gololo or Golo? Gololo. Gololo. Okay, thanks. How do you know that the gold is illegal? When you look at the refiner, you find that there's a small refiner. He says to us he receives scrap metal. From scrap metal, he extracts gold. You look at the tonnages of gold that he's refining. You look at the scrap metal that he's receiving. These things, they should balance. There should be a lot of scraps to extract gold. But if another guy has received few scraps, you know, a ton or two scraps of gold, but he produced a ton of gold, these things are not balanced. Then immediately it gives you an indication that somewhere there's a spike. This guy doesn't get gold from scraps. He gets gold from somewhere. Then that's how we get them. And also their books, you know, a small refiner cannot have millions and millions of rands or is getting his gold from scraps. This thing should balance. If you look at the biggest refiners in the country, you look at the amount of gold that they're getting from the mines, it balances. You look at the accounting will tell you immediately. That's how we discover this guy. But then it's up to the police to find out where he's getting gold. Because for us, we've given an indication where something is wrong, but for us, it's an intelligent matter to find out where the gold is coming from. Some that is beyond our capacity. I think I've responded to some. Can I maybe touch on the fair market value? I don't know. On the fair market value, how it is becoming a problem. Our GDVs, how they determine the fair market value, they look at international prices. They are telling us all over the world. And they do their research on a weekly basis to say in particular area the price of per carat is so much for this particular goods price, per carat in this particular. And then they take an average that this is an international fair market price for this type of goods. And then that's how they approach the goods that are submitted by the producer and say, according to our knowledge and research, this is a fair market value. A tender value is very, very difficult to say. Tender value is determined by one. Fair market value is determined by one tender house. Because what can happen in one tender house, there can be someone with a lot of money. He can outbid you. He can kill the balance of the average of goods that are there. And that distorts the market price. And if a person is going to say, this is a market price because it was determined in the tender house, to us, that is very artificial. It's very artificial. We cannot use that as a market price. Because it's a small area where people were fighting for price, and one with the deepest pocket decided to distort the market. And you cannot come to us and say, this is a market price. And this thing, it's happening at DC. We are also at the GDV. We make it a point that diamonds that are leaving the country, we make it a point that they leave this country at a fair market value so that people don't launder money, because there is that possibility that people launder money using diamonds. So we make it a point that diamonds leaving the country are leaving the country at a fair market value. We also assist us in collecting the levy that is due, also people not to undervalue goods, to avoid paying a levy. We say that these goods are undervalued. We cannot allow them to leave this country. This is the fair market value. High or low, we tolerate a range of 20%. Anything below 20% to us is acceptable. Anything astronomical, we stop the export and say it's not acceptable. It's not a fair market. So this principle, I think it applies to producers. It applies to every dealer. We cannot really allow people to play around with prices. That's our function as a regulator, and also the function of the GDV, to see that the playing fields are level.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, there was a proposal from Honorable Charlie around the unsigned auditor's report, which I want to say that it's similar to what we have discussed. Because when you look at the annual reports, both State Diamond Trader and this institution, you find out that there's only a stamp. If you look at the last page of the auditor's report, in both instances, it's quite similar. And I think we would, I think we agree with Honorable Charlie that indeed you need here a document that is authentic and that is, you know, can be traced back to the Auditor General. But then the choice we are faced with is, that's why I posed the question whether there's material difference between that report, which contains the signature, and what is before us, so that we base our discussions on this, and then we find a way of verifying similarities or otherwise on both instances. I think that's the choice we're faced with here in terms of the way forward. But let me get the views of the honourable members. In this instance, I think we're not discounting what Honourable Charlie raised, because whether you tabled the report in September without the signature, but coming here to basically present it, you should have afforded us an opportunity with a signed document. Having said so, we need then to look at the reality of the situation, that you are now here and that you intend expenses to be here. There's time of this committee, and therefore we need to find a middle way that will take us through in both instances. Hence, my suggestion would be that let's then find mechanisms for them to send the signed and task either a small committee here or the office of the chairperson to peruse those documents and confirm whether there's departure from what is being here. May I hasten to notify the members that I have got an outstanding appointment with the Auditor General. It was supposed to be last week it's been postponed. Because also in reading through these reports of the state-owned enterprises, you get a sense that there are some areas that require engagement and to understand from the part of the Auditor General. Because, you know, it's one thing to not qualify a report, but then you go on raise a host of issues of compliance. For instance, in the instance of this institution that we're discussing now, hence members were saying that this financial statement makes it easy. There's quite a serious list that the auditor, you know, developed to say that there are these serious concerns. But when you look at his or her opinion, even preceding this list, say he made an assertion that without, you know, qualifying my report, I have the following concerns to raise. To us, it's either you are happy that things were done properly and then that's it, or you are not happy. and therefore issue qualification, because you know we're handling taxpayers' money, and therefore we need to be quite clear on this matter. So, honourable members, in a roundabout way, I'm persuading you that let's discuss and then verify once we have given the signed copies. If indeed the two institutions have misled us, you know already that we there are consequences. For instance, if you look at the SCOPA, where some of the key officials misled Parliament there, there were consequences. And in this case, there will be consequences that, the institutions, the accounting, bodies of the institutions will be faced with. So I'm with that in mind, persuading yourselves that let's discuss, because at some point we're going to consider all these reports, which means we'll either adopt or not adopt. For now, we're discussing, we're clarifying, we're engaging. At one meeting that we will schedule, we will table all of them to look at whether we approve them or not. But let me hear you out on this one. I see that you would want to respond, Honorable Makakule, followed by Honorable Mathieu.
Chairperson, I think because we did that in the first one, I saw as we started speaking that she quickly moved out. And then
the CEO.
And then I think, Chairperson, let's do according to your way. Let's give them the chance to distribute documents with their signature. But whereas we agreed about the information that they've been given to us, because I think they are tired to be grilled. and then we'll just give to the secretary of the committee, that the secretary will take to the chairperson. The chairperson and some other members will just look the document that is it, or what is in this document, is in this document, and then I think on that way, chairperson, it will be fine.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would also agree to what you were saying, Chairperson, because once we agree on this, tomorrow we are going to be very answerable as a committee. It won't be their fault, it will be us as this committee. We once went through such a thing where an amendment was supposed to have been put there. They said, okay, Chairperson, you do it. But it ended up with the Chairperson. So we don't want to repeat the same mistake. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Holon.
Thank you very much. Let me also agree with my colleagues here to say that, yeah, let's take it your way. But let's put some time frame. The sooner, in fact, the better. Thank you.
What you're saying, I have to get from what you're saying. Because I didn't see this, but that is not bad.
They are on the same category. But what are you suggesting?
Honorable Mchani, what I'm suggesting is that let's use these documents for discussion purposes. You ask questions, clarify, and so forth. Now, the both institutions must send us as soon as possible, because they say they are in possession of the signed Auditor General's reports. And therefore, once they have sent them through, it's either this committee can establish a small committee to verify
the answer that they gave to my question was when I asked whether what that which is signed by the Auditor General is the same in content as the one that they presented before us. And their answer was yes. And I went on to say they must take note that if it is not true, it therefore would mean that they have misled Parliament by saying that they presented a documentation which is a true reflection of what the Auditor General has done. If it is not true, then there will be consequences. If it is true, then it's fine. So what members are agreeing upon is that let it not be only the office of the chairperson to peruse the correctness of that document. We must have some other members here sitting with that information to verify. So that's what is being seconded, Honorable Chair.
Okay, not taking a danger. That the balance will come here with the, around the
sea. Are we not take a day of that department coming with the, don't say incorrect reports, but reports that
is
yeah, maybe even to say not authentic is not correct because what we don't know. Maybe they might be authentic, but with such type of reports, and we endorse them. And tomorrow another one will cover such a report. And it means we are not doing our oversight properly.
What I've said, Honorable Members, is that all these reports, we listened to the presentation, trying to assist us to understand them. But there will come a day before we could take them to the main chamber, where this committee must then consider the report. For now, we received the presentations, we engaged with those presentations, and then it's like the outstanding report on oversight on illegal mining. That report cannot leave this committee before it's signed off by this committee, similar to this annual report, starting from the one of DME to all the other five state-owned enterprises. We're remaining now with two, with one that we're going to listen to next week, Mine Health and Safety Council annual report. Then the next round would be to then consider those reports, where then the committee must say, yes, we're happy, or the committee must say, no, we're not happy. So I think we have a safeguard there that we have not approved them or rejected them. We just received the presentations we're discussing in terms of questions and answers, and then they will come back here via us as now the committee to say, do you approve this report? The answer would be yes, or do it, and so forth. So there you have the safety valve.
But we don't discuss that. But we come back for this.
It's only next year. We have got time with these reports until most probably March. Because this financial period we're dealing with is annual report running up to March next year. Honorable Murray?
The person he says maybe three members of this committee available next week to assist you quickly to go through it and check if it's the correct stuff. And I'm prepared to sit on that committee and rectify it if necessary to go away, please.
Are you available? So it's Honorable Gololo? You're not? Okay. Honorable Murray? Second one, Honorable Tindo. Third one? No, he's changed his mind.
of course,
I sense his lazy change. But Honorable Mchali, are you at least comfortable?
Why do we go to such an extent of meeting and discuss something, some other people's mistakes, and we make it our responsibility? Do we really have to do that instead of them? Because even if they go out and correct it, then it comes back to this committee, Yabo Njali, No Makakula, and the rest. So that you should sit down, spare your time, and do it. And where are they at that time? Why can't they do it themselves? And really, I think it's not real to accept something that we see it is wrong. We all right, Honorable Tindo said we are also wrong because we accepted it. We left them to give it to us, and we discussed it, seeing that it is wrong, but I don't think it's right. There's something that doesn't come well to me. It's not worth sitting down and do other people's job.
Honorable Magagule and Honorable members, we were here. We allow the department, those presentation to be tabled in front of us. We engage it. And yes, we realize the problem. You know, if we didn't allow the first one, and it would be fine, said, no, all of you will have to go back. But we even now tell them that, no, look, this thing is not signed. And actually, as a members, we already agreed that it's not the work, actually. It's just the to compare that what is written here is the one that is here. Only. It's not the work. So I think, honorable members, let us not just be that much hardened. And because. Okay, I think.
Honorable Matibela, and then we will have to make a ruling on
that. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, as you were saying, at first you were talking about this other report. Now, the first report, which we did not look at, on page 33 of the annual report on the state day monthly prayer, findings on performance information, non-compliance with regularity requires inadequate quarterly reporting on performance information. So I agree with Honorable Ngele, because we will be talking only about it, and it won't come all in this form. This is a different book at all. Because the things that we are going to agree on, those other things which are not correct will be still here. And when we are asked in the House to look at this and be pointed out, here, what did you do? Then we are tongue-tied. We won't have any response. I think they should go back and rework this, all this.
I think we would, honorable members, I think we started with the main annual report of the department. We have not accepted or rejected that report. still pending. We came to the annual report of Geoscience. We have not accepted or rejected that report. All we are doing, we are listening. It's like public hearing. Then we will come back as a committee in one day or whatever to look at each report. Do we accept it? Do we not accept it? That's when then this very pertinent question will come in. What is a misnomer here is that these two reports are not accompanied with a signed Auditor General's report. It's here. That's why we ask the question, is that one which is signed different from this one? This committee is not going to do other people's work. It's going to look at, did they tell us the truth when they said this is the same? We can do it the other way. We can ask you to please bring us that report on Wednesday. We're meeting on Wednesday in our ordinary, what you call, each member receives his or her copy. When we discuss these reports, if we pick up that there's a difference, then we reject your report with the consequences that go with that. How is that, honorable members? Because now we're not calling for the acceptance or rejection of the report. All we're doing, we're just listening to the presentations. They're trying to clarify the reports to us. And we will then get our own time of engaging on that report in terms of with a view of adopting it or rejecting those reports. How is that? I'm noticing you, Honorable Tinto and Honorable Just.
Chairperson, you proposed a process that we seconded that process, that we get three people that will assist with the report, and we supported that. So can we go with that process? And also, you know, when the annual reports come to us, they come with compliance or non-compliance. There's no way that they can hide it. If they complied, they bring it here. And if they did not comply, they bring it here. It's just that the reports were not signed by the Auditor General, which is unusual. So that's the only reason why you have to look again at the report and get the signed one by the Auditor General.
Thank you. Well, honorable members, I think, so thank you for that, but this is one of the lessons as we move on. But we ask you that before Wednesday next week, or the latest by Wednesday, we must get those signed copies so that the three members will sit and look just the comparison. And then we'll engage on that. But I wanted to check with yourselves, both reports. Yes. The state demonstrator is still here. They will also do the same. Can I check with yourselves, the regulators? You know, you in terms of the achievements, you've got figures that you are giving us. Were these the targeted figures? Because your report is so mean that in the presentation, it doesn't give us an indication whether you targeted so many licenses that must be issued, and therefore you were able to issue so many. But just give us a broad answer on those figures in under achievements, whether that's what you have there. And secondly, this comes up for the second time, the question of the court challenges. Honorable Schmidt indicated that this is even challenged on the basis of this act. It's of the COVID constitutionality. Can you just spend a moment with us so that we understand what is being challenged? Because it's our law that was passed by the third parliament. So we need to know exactly, what are the possibilities in terms of what is being discussed. And indeed, in terms of your financial statement, the auditor's report, you know, you've done quite well in terms of giving us management comments. But even the management comments, in many instances, they fall short. For instance, if you look at your your very first one in point number 8, where you talk about preparation of the financial statements as determined by the National Treasury policy. You're not indicating how far are you in that process. Secondly, on point 11, you have adequately, you know, answered us by saying that all monies that were in this account were basically used up, and the account is now closed. But then the requirement, if you look on the other hand, is making reference to the revenue fund, which must be administered by the main department. You're not basically assisting us to understand your process in as far as that is concerned. And then, you know, this thing of one member who sat in the tender process and with his or her company having an interest, you know, this thing is going to be picked up by the media. And then you are not telling us exactly by, except by saying that the person has declared. Normally, one would declare and recuse him or herself from that process. But your answer here is not clarifying whether there has been recusal from the process. I'm talking to yourselves. You seem to be holding another. Whether there has been recusal, because we need to understand the impact of the cognizance that you have taken on this issue as raised by. On the 10 million rand, you're making, you know, a statement there that, you know, there was a provision for a writing off. Are you saying that the 10 million rand transfer to Mintec has been written off, you know, from your books? Written off as what? As an unrecoverable, you know, kind of money, whereas you have deliberately transferred that money to Mintec to deal with the issue of illegal, you know, diamonds. So I think you have been a bit unclear there. You need absolute clarity in terms of that. You know, you're saying that you are taking steps to approach Treasury to ratify this. You know, this irregular expense, but you're falling short because you're talking about it being written off. You know, and it's quite a large sum of money that you are talking about. So basically, I'm saying that there are those areas that require some form of. Lastly, on point 13, the Auditor General in the last financial year raised concerns on matters of non-compliance. But in your response, you are still working on that. On top of those that were raised on the last financial year, there are others that are raised now. This long list that we are talking about. If you are still working on those, what could be the reason for that? Because we can't accept this. You know, that coming from the previous financial year, you have not acted adequately on the Auditor General's, you know, concerns of non-compliance and gap going into your second financial year, which you are now presenting to us. How sure must we be that these concerns that are now raised by the Auditor General will be acted upon? So those are some of the areas that are boggling my mind in terms of this report. Please respond.
Thank you, Chair. I think I will give to the CEO, the acting CEO, to attend to other matters, and I'll come in and see if also is available to get answer to the respond to the question.
Okay, Chairperson, on achievement of our target, we did put the targets to be achieved, but the targets that we put for ourselves were more of theoretical, because the information that we obtained for the licenses that were in existence, especially the precious metals was not granted by the regulator during that time. It was the police and other institutions that granted those particular businesses. It was difficult for us. All we did is took the database from the police and said, okay, in the precious metal there are so many licenses that are in existence in terms of the legislation. And then we told ourselves that in order to reach this target, we expect 60% of those licenses to be renewed or to be continued with. We did set a target. It's just that in the reporting, we, as I said, that the new threat that we put for ourselves, the reporting is going to be done in a performance way. In our threat, we put the objectives, we put the target, we put everything, so it will be reported that way. But I must say that in this case, although we did it, but we didn't report it in our report. And as far as diamonds are concerned, it was easy because the diamond board was issuing the diamond licenses. The target was set, and it was exceeded because there were many people that applied, and the target was exceeded, but it was not reported at all. We can rectify that situation if we're required to do that. Thanks.
Through you, Chair, I would like just to talk on the 10 million rand, whether it is the provision for the write-off. What the Auditor General suggested was that in the contract that we have with MinTech, there is a provision for royalties at 25% to be paid over, to be paid back to the regulator when this project is fully functional, is being used. Whoever from the neighboring countries wants to use this project, they would have to pay a fee. But we looked at the time that it will take for that to happen. We are expecting this project to start bearing fruit maybe five years down the line. So our original viewpoint was that at least we could sort of like write it down over maybe the period of 5 years, say 2 million per annum and so on. But they felt no, because there is nothing tangible at this stage to suggest that funds will start flowing into the regulator anytime in the near future. So they said no, rather impair. Keep it in the balance sheet, but impair. In other words, you are showing it as an expense on your income statement, but you still keep it. In other words, we've got an asset and a provision in the balance sheet. It's there. It's not going to disappear. But it's not an asset in its true sense of a definition of an asset. Simply because no one can ascertain how long it will take for those royalties to start flowing into the coffers of the regulator. That is why now the auditor said, no, let us be on the safe side. Let us not put too much hope in this project. It's a viable project. It's going to be useful once it can be used. But right now, we have nothing to show for it. It's only that the money has gone out of our bank, it has been invested in the system. They are, however, giving us reports of what they are doing, where they are with this project, how much money of the 10 million have they spent into it, because they are coming with their know-how, but they There is nothing right now that one can say is a benefit out of the 10 million rand as yet. So the other chair said, no, let us rather not show it as an asset alone. Let us show it as an asset and also as a provision. That is the impairment. If something can happen, for example, last year and next year, this provision can be reversed. So that is what the accounting treatment requires us to do. On the other issues of, for example, not addressing the issues raised previously by the Auditor General, I don't want just to put blame on other people, but on the ground there, one would wish it can be done within a week or a month. But there are a number of challenges. For example, with the issue of the Audit Committee, members resign, others don't come to meetings, and then decisions cannot be taken. You've got key employees resigning. And then you have to start now looking around for people to take over those positions, and you still have to train them when they come on board. I mean, there are many challenges, not that we deliberately ignore them, but I know that it doesn't look good. We are fully aware of that. We're discussing it, but on the ground, sometimes you get so frustrated that you don't know what to do, because you have people that are employed that sometimes are not necessarily up to speed, but there's not much you can do about them. You train them. It takes a while for them to understand where you want to go. So It's just one of those things, but we are working on it. It is a serious challenge. We have to work on it and really get employees to understand that when we are at work, we are not on holiday.
Okay.
Yeah, but okay, let me just look maybe item number 13. Sorry. Number. Oh, okay. On the issue of the member who sat on the audit committee while his company was providing some services, what happened is that his company had been appointed to do the work. But then when we looked at the capacity of the audit committee, that we're looking for people to make the necessary quorum so that the meetings can be legal. He happened to be one of the people we could approach, but he was already doing the work. His company was already doing the work that we had assigned them to do. So he actually joined later. The assignment was not given to his company when he was already serving. We only co-opted him later because of his experience, his contributions, his view, his viewpoints. He's a very, very useful member on the audit committee. But the contract was already there. But now we decided that what do? We end the contract or we ask him to leave? We need his services. He's a very, very useful member. We have decided to terminate the contract to make a full employment for that position for which one of his employees was doing. So the contract has been terminated. But we have retained him in the audit committee because he's a very, very useful member. If he steps down now again, then our audit committee does not have a quorum. And then again, we go back to the audit committee being dysfunctional, like it has been happening over the years. And then we are back to school. And because to find these people, it's also quite a challenge because they have got their own companies, they've got their own clients that they must service, they've got their own. It's very, very difficult, but we are trying to work with those that we can find. Thank you.
Okay. I think as we have indicated, we would await those signed documents, and it would be in your favor that when we sit to consider these reports, yours included, that you have a delegation. If it's one person or two people, because then you would be in a position to assist the committee to navigate through those reports. Otherwise, you have been here, you've presented your report and so forth. So the secretary of the committee will put it on the order paper the day, sometime early next year, when we are going to be considering all these reports for purposes of adoption or rejection. And then to prevent rejection, that's why I'm saying it will be working in your favor if you are around, so that you are able to clarify some of the issues that members will have difficulty on. Because through clarity, people might then gain more understanding and be able to then defend themselves. One member was raising a very serious issue here, that you confirm or adopt a report when it gets debated in the House. People who are not necessarily even sitting in this committee raise pertinent issues because these are public documents. Anybody has access, to those documents. So for now, let's thank you very much, both yourselves and the State Diamond Traders, for being here. And I would want also to thank members for their participation, robust engagement in these documents since we started looking at these annual reports, and encourage you to further read so that when we come to considering these reports at the final stage, then we are able to make up our own minds in terms of what is it that we would want to do with them. With that, unfortunately, with the situation where our tea was reportedly taken by the committee next door,
now there's tea and coffee out there, for what it's worth. Even on your way out, you can grab a cup of coffee or tea. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.